Well, when we got done yesterday, we had gotten disillusioned with the life of pleasure and following, you know, one's own impulses, one's own desires, things of that sort. Or we hadn't really gotten tired of it, but we couldn't afford it anymore. You know, you run out of money or whatever it takes to be able to keep on living that way. And so consequently, one begins to reach around and look around for something that is going to make life worth living. Now let me approach it particularly from the standpoint of getting tired of the life that's totally oriented to pleasure. You know, you don't care if you never go to another party. You're jaded, you've had it, you're bored, life is dull, and everything else. And so consequently, you try to find something which will make life worth living once again. Now, the life, the aesthetical kind of life that we talked about last time, is a kind of life where the goal is found inside oneself. In other words, you are giving pleasure to yourself. The goal of life is to have a ball, to titillate your nerve endings. You know, to life is one continual giggle or one continual tickle. So the goal is inside oneself, and sooner or later, this serious, intelligent person begins to realize that there must be some purpose to life beyond me. In other words, what was life for before I existed? What's life going to be for after I'm gone? I'm not the reason why the whole universe exists, and so thinking begins to move toward an external goal for existence from an internal goal for existence. Now, what inevitably happens then, as soon as you talk about external goals are separated from oneself. You heard about a bunch of external goals at the end of the last period, you know, where it took 5 years to do this. It took 3 years to do that. Well, what are we talking about? All of a sudden, we're in a time dimension. And where the aesthetical kind of life, where you live for the pleasure of the moment, is a kind of life that, in a sense, tries to deny time and to escape from time. And this is why it's a youthful kind of life. Because youthful people almost seem to defy time. I've got some youthful people in my chalet who really don't believe that sleep was intended for anybody. You know, if you can't think of anything else, you sleep. But, you know, no youthful person goes to sleep. You know, so you stay up all night, you do this, you do that. I have four girls in one bedroom, and so you know what that means. They sit up till 3 o'clock in the morning talking. And they fall asleep, you know. Sleep overcomes them, but they don't go to sleep. So, you know, that was that kind of life. But now you begin to think in terms of time. And you begin to think in terms of long-range goals. And in a sense, you kind of go from the extreme of proximate, immediate goals. Something I have today, I want it right now, kind of existence. Like the little child for whom the word tomorrow doesn't mean anything different from next week. Tomorrow, next week, a year from now, all of that sort of vaguely means sometime after lunch today. See, but there, it just doesn't work that way. Well, the same with this kind of a life. You know, there's a kind of ambiguity about time, and what is significant is what I can get real quick. And this is why oftentimes people that live this kind of life will live for a little bang right now, when next week they could have a big bang. But their attitude is, you know, what's next week? He may never come. So I have my little bang right now that I have. I suspect that's where a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush comes from. And I've never respected that aphorism too much. Because it's a kind of live in the present sort of thing. Burn it up now. There's a story, I think by Theodor Storm, a short story from the 19th century called Gustav Adolf's Pasha, the page of Gustav Adolf. You know how many Swedes are present this morning? Gustav Adolf was the great Lutheran king who almost pulled it off in the 30 Years' War. Well, anyway, Gustav Adolf, this is the story about how Gustav Adolf died and how his page died. It's completely romantic and totally fictional, but in the story, his page is a girl about 15 years old. He didn't know it until she was dead. He thought she was a young boy. But anyway, she loved her emperor so much, she just had to serve him, and she managed to get to be his page and look after his needs and so on. Well, anyway, at the Battle of Lützen, where he was killed, she is killed first, you know, and she's struck in the chest. And he tears open her blouse and, to his great horror, discovers this is a girl. Well, she has a little, the point of what I'm making is that she had a little necklace with a little saying on it. And the little saying was short and sweet. A short life, but everything packed into it. You know, have it now, and then over with it. Die young. You know, the Pepsi generation, the whole bit, you know. The Schlitz commercial, you only go around once, grab the brass ring. So you'd be amazed how many of these drink commercials are oriented to the aesthetic whole life. Have it now. If you got it, flaunt it, is what we used to get from Braniff Airlines. See, the now generation, all of these expressions characteristic of the aesthetic whole life. Well, it's gone. One of these days we're going to be studying it in history classes. That whole cultural thing we can't afford anymore. But anyway, we begin to look for goals that lie outside of oneself, and goals that lie outside of oneself are not immediately attainable. They take time, and so consequently one has to take time into consideration. The goal then becomes not the pleasant life, but the goal becomes the good life. Because the external goal which is worth attaining is a goal which is a good goal. And so now we shift from our ultimate values of pro values and con values being pleasure and pain to good and evil. And we seek the good life and we try to avoid the bad life. And so we become moral. How does one become moral? How does one become ethical? By putting yourself under a universal rule. Now, Kierkegaard talks about rational rules, and by that he simply means that they hold universally. They're universal principles. And so we begin to operate a life within or under these kind of universal principles. We organize our life. We work out schedules. And we set goals for ourselves that we attempt to realize. Now, this may be on the individual level. This may be on the family level. It may be on the national level. You know, you may have five-year plans or things of this sort. We're in Congress. We're starting to talk the way the Russians have for many, many years about five-year planning, 10-year planning, things of that sort. Well, this is the essence of the ethical life. You know, it's so much a part of our life that we take it for granted. Instead of dune bugging around across the prairie in the middle of the country, we build superhighways. And we organize it so that a lot of people can travel in a lot of places and things of that sort. See, the places like the wilderness area to the west of us here get smaller and smaller as we organize the earth for the achievement of good goals. From a nutritional survival standpoint, the aesthetical kind of life, I suppose, is the Tarzan kind of existence, where you wander through the forest and you live on berries and roots and things of that sort, which you happen to run across. The ethical life is you organize and plant a garden. See, so it's not just morals that are involved here, but it's organized, planned, controlled existence, where you make life less and less haphazard, more and more controlled, predictable. You invent sciences in order to do this kind of job, to do that kind of job, and so on. So life gets very secure or increasingly secure. Well, every once in a while you have an avalanche or an earthquake or a volcanic eruption or a tornado, you know, that breaks it loose again. But for the most part, you get it domesticated. I think one of the most fascinating differences between aesthetical mountains like we've got here around us at Holden and ethical mountains like they have in Switzerland is that you travel in Switzerland and you look at the Alps in Switzerland, it looks like they take them in every night, manicure them, and stick them out again the next morning. You know, and you get up to the top of a very high mountain in Switzerland and you think, gee, here I am in the wilds, and all of a sudden you hear cowbells and a herd of cows comes wandering to you. Well, you sure aren't going to run into that up at Holden Lake, you know, or up on Martin's Ridge or something like that, although some years ago on the other side of Martin's Ridge they used to raise sheep in the summer. But, you know, the mountains have to some extent gotten controlled. Here, if you want to see what the top of Bonanza Peak looks like, you got to scramble and take your life in your hands and try to pick your way. You know, and there's no book that can tell you exactly how to do it. But then we got domesticated mountains where you take a cog railroad to the top or a lift, you know, and zoom, there you are at the top of the Zugspitze or something like that, you know, and there you stand on top and have your photograph taken. You have conquered that mountain. See, that we ethicalize life. We organize life. And it's a more satisfactory life. Now, if you do it right, and I'm going to do a little excursus here because so many people, including Kierkegaard lovers, misunderstand Kierkegaard. If you do it right, you can have your cake and eat it too. In other words, the ethical life is not necessarily against the aesthetical life. In other words, it's not just one big bore. You go ethical when you make this decision to live, you know, the disciplined life rather than the undisciplined life, because you believe you can get more pleasure out of it, or you can get pleasure once again where you couldn't from the previous kind of life. And so consequently, the one doesn't necessarily end the other one. Now, oftentimes when we're teenagers, we think it will. Tomorrow I have to go to work for the first time and the end of my life has come. See? Or tomorrow I'm getting married, so tonight I'm having a bachelor party and we're all going to get stinking drunk because that's the end of the carefree life. You know, see, sometimes we do tend to have that kind of feeling. We're stuck in the 9-to-5 grind from here on in. I've got to join the rest of the human race and I've had it. You know, life's over. And whether it's, you know, getting a job, or whether you've got to do dishes tonight, or two of my daughters complain about they have to practice their violin. And why do you have to do that at Holden, where you're supposed to be having fun? You know, regardless of what it is, you may have that kind of situation. But if the ethical life is done right, it not only is aesthetically satisfying, but it is likely to give more satisfaction than the aesthetical life did. Now, one thing has to be borne in mind, and that is that when one becomes ethical, one's taste change also. And oftentimes one's become ethical because, you know, you have a feeling that life is more than half a dozen big kicks. And there's got to be something more to life than that. Well, the aesthetical life isn't attractive anymore because you've changed. And so you want something which has more to offer than the aesthetical life.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, Paul.
The ethical life, then, is the sort of a routinized life, the ordered existence.
Yeah, I like ordered existence better than routinized.
Isn't that simply man's, the definition that men have evolved for what is ethical, for what is good? Is this necessarily the true meaning of the word ethics?
Now, I said we're using the word ethical now to describe a kind of way of living. And it's broader than just morality. You know, it's super highways rather than paths through the prairie.
By ethical,
he's simply meaning life in accordance with reason, where on the aesthetical level, the primary faculty that moved it all was the emotions. On the ethical level, you know, it's reason. You attempt to live intelligently. See? Yeah, which may or may not have anything to do with what we call philosophical ethics.
Okay.
See? And for that matter, philosophical ethics also applies on the aesthetical level. In other words, there's such a thing as an ethical and an unethical aesthetical life. See, in the sense of philosophic ethics. So consequently, the term ethical as a second stage doesn't mean that before this you're amoral and now you're moral. But it means that you move from a kind of existence where what moved you was, you know, how you felt about things, or what you, you know, what turned you on at this point, what turned you on at that point, and you used your rational capacities to get what you wanted. On this level, you're now using your rational capacities to deliberate about what you ought to do.
An emotional type of existence.
Sure.
Was a reason.
This is now reason kind of existence. Yeah. You get sayings like, the unexamined life is not worth living. That's a typical ethical stage type remark. Look before you leap. Think before you act. All of these are characteristics of the ethical type of existence. Most of us live in this kind of a milieu. And we do here even at Holden, although we try to keep it down to a minimum so that we can still draw on the ascetical environment with which we're surrounded, so that we don't vacuum the village, you know, and organize the whole business, you know, and build a giant wall around the village and paint mountains on it, on which we play different colored lights at different times of day to simulate sunrise, high noon, evening, you know, and so on. See, that's a completely organized wilderness. So what we try to do here is to, you know, get the best of both worlds.
Ethical, I see it coming out as control.
Yeah.
Control.
Well, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where you attempt to control it for the purpose of goals that you think are worth having.
Which may be meanness.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Well, you take utilitarianism. You know, the greatest pleasure to the greatest number. You know, basic principle of utilitarianism, and it's a very reasoned kind of thing. Epicureanism was a highly rational kind of approach to life. And even when you're dealing with hedonism, you know, what may turn you on is bringing happiness to people. And so you become the world's greatest philanthropist. See?
Yeah. Or even bumper sticker ethics. Feel good, do it, or taste good, eat it.
Yeah, well, that's sort of borderline. Now,
at least what those bumper stickers are is the norm by which they are making rational decisions.
Right. Oh, that's sure. And in addition to that, it wouldn't be a bumper sticker if the individual did not believe that this should be universal ethical principle. See, in other words, they are converting an individual. They're converting an individual impulse to all mankind ought to live this way. Sort of, you know, which then makes it an ethical principle. You know, whether good or bad ethical principle, it's being made a principle. Because on the aesthetical level, it's pretty much every man for himself. I can't feel your nerve endings. See, and what I can't tie, at least at the present state of physiological research, we can't tie into somebody else's nerve endings and feel his kicks. You know, so it's every man has his own experience, and so it tends to be a loner kind of deal. Well, the paradigm model of the ethical stage is Socrates, just as Don Juan was the model for the aesthetical life, for the supreme exemplification of that kind of life. Socrates, who introduced in a society that believed in complete relativity of values and meanings, introduced the idea that there is such a thing as objective truth and there's such a thing as objective goodness. One of the key words of the ethical life is objectivity. We have moved from subjectivity to objectivity. We get our meanings and values not from the subject who experiences things, but from the objects which are experienced and achieved. And so consequently, what one does is one dedicates oneself to the achievements of goals outside oneself. Now this leads inevitably to the point of self-sacrifice. On the aesthetical level, self-sacrifice would never have occurred, except accidentally. But on the ethical life, it doesn't take long before it gets to be almost the essence of the ethical life. You serve others. You contribute of your abilities, of your wealth, and so on, to achieve a particular thing. You send in your annual contribution to Holden Village, even if you can't make it every year, so that others may enjoy it. See, that's part of the business. See, and you begin to become less and less important, and the goals and the ideals become more and more important. You get group behavior beginning to form. You get communities forming to attempt to find that elusive thing called joy. Now that was being discussed last night. Societies form, countries form, cities form, cultures form, all sorts of things form for the achievement of goals, which are objective. And so we get a highly cultivated society. The church is not immune also. What was the expression, the new expression you learned this morning at 8:30 about the institutional church? Is it churchified? Churchianity. All right. Kierkegaard uses the word Christendom. The trouble with Christianity is it has been destroyed by Christendom. This is why, and I'll talk a bit more about it tomorrow morning at this time, Kierkegaard finally reached the point, having looked at the Church of Denmark, where he concluded that it was very possible that he might be the only living Christian. All the rest was institutional church, which had nothing to do with Christianity. See, it was religion ethicized, organized, systematized, reduced to a rote. One of the examples you heard this morning. See, the sharing of the sacrament of the altar was a family event. That's what you heard last period. Was a family event. And what is it today? Particularly in high liturgical circles, it's a highly dramatic, stylized, highly colorful event with gobs of banners, sacraments, incense, organ playing, choir singing, great big spectacular event. And that's what's happened to it. See, it's over-ethicized. The sharing of the faith by means of evangelism used to be, a person-to-person kind of thing, or a person seeing another person and overhearing them, which I think oftentimes was more effective evangelism than buttonholing somebody. What is it now? We now have plans for mass conversion, don't we? And you go to a weekend seminar where they teach you how to convert 100 people a week. You got mass production conversion to Christianity, kind of a throwback to the days of Charlemagne when they used to herd a tribe together inside fences and squirt a hose over the top of them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Let them out and say, okay, fellas, you've had it. Your freedom's over. You're now Christians. See, and there were added to the church daily, so many.
Is that why you started rebelling today?
Oh, sure, I think they tend to see a lot of phoniness.
Ones that really were brought up in church
Yeah. Yeah, well, the complaint is, and we're starting to get to the limitations of the ethical life now, and why that can't be the end of the line. You know, if that's the end of the line, life's not worth living. There's got to be something better than the ethical life. Just like there's got to be something better than the aesthetical life. There must be something to make life more meaningful than just law and order and that kind of stuff. Because it becomes impersonal. You know, the whole complaint about, I'm a computer number. I'm a slug in the church addressograph system. Mm-hmm. You know, I get the mimeograph. My only contact with my pastor is the monthly mimeograph letter. And I sit here and he stands way up there 150 feet away from me every Sunday morning. See, church has got to be something more than that. I think a great deal of the talk that was going on last night, and I was listening rather than talking, a great deal of the talk that was going on last night and the reaching out that was going on last night was a saying, church has got to be more than big organization as we've made it.
Amen.
You know, where you got big structure. Parish that I belong to has 1,900 members. And most of the 1,900 are fairly active, and most of them don't know one another. And it's not a very friendly church for a very simple reason, that nobody goes and greets anybody that they've never seen before because it may be a fellow member and they don't want to be embarrassed. So they don't greet anybody. Yeah, well, that's horrible. And that's why you've got a kind of feeling developing of what we need is little groups. What we need is small churches. We've got to break up the great big piles and start over again smaller. We should put a limit on how big a church may be. But once again, that's an ethical decision about an ethical situation. Thou shalt not be any larger than 500 communicants. Or something like that. See? But you reach a point, I don't know how many of you have at some time or other been a member of a mission church and helped it struggle into size, you know, and you think back, you're smiling, you think back on how great it was. It was so great, you know, because you couldn't afford yourself, so you gave every nickel you had. So you could survive as a parish. You know, and now you haul a buck out of your pocket and toss it in the collection plate because, you know, you can afford to toss a buck in and the parish goes.
Is that church egotism?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. But what tends to happen is it gets all structured and becomes classical. It's all structured, organized, laid out, and robotized. You go through the motions and you have to sweat to make it alive. Sometimes. And the younger ones react against it, particularly the little younger ones. They're the small ones. As soon as this starts happening, they're not with it anymore. They've been left behind. Older people were used to getting systematized, organized, and everything else. Look how many years we spent in school being organized. Taught to sit up straight like I'm not doing now. I have been a rebel all my life because I had several teachers that insisted on that. So ever since I've deliberately slouched. Plus it helps to be tall. Any of us that are tall, we can't sit up straight anyway. Our bodies won't allow that. But all right, you know, we're organized, we're systematized. We have an organized, systematized educational system, and we got an organized, systematized church system, you know, and we regularize everything. Partly because there are so many of us, it's the only way we can handle it.
There's a need sometimes.
Yeah, you have to organize it. When you get beyond a certain point, you have to organize it. You can't operate with spontaneity. I think one of the reasons why the charismatic movement got going was because it placed a very heavy emphasis on spontaneity, right? Sure. You know, the Spirit moves you and you get up and testify. And you simply create an environment in which people can be spontaneous with one another.
The human body doesn't like to be in bondage.
No. Whether it's rules and regulations or corsets. Oh, sure.
Or shoes.
You're right, Paul.
But it doesn't, because it realizes that there, you're not organized, you're going to be oppressing me. So yeah, you know, it's got to be good for me then too, sort of.
Right. And the impulse when you're in the ethical life, you know, and the more you're in the ethical life, what tends to happen is the ruts get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and all of a sudden you realize that for 20 years you've been getting up at 6:30 a.m., eating breakfast at 7 a.m., and leaving on the commuter train for downtown at 7:30. And you say, there must be more to life than this. And what do you think about? You think about when you were a kid, you didn't have to work. You think about the good old days of the aesthetical life, right? Sure. What Kierkegaard says is, you know, that's never Neverland. It's not going to happen again. You can't go back from the ethical life to the aesthetical life. If you do, it's immoral. See, if you go backwards, it's immoral. It has to be. There's no way to escape it. You can only go forward.
That's why the good Lord gave you imagination.
Well, sure.
When you're in these different stages, to see what you as an individual can do about it. And you don't look over your shoulder sometimes and see what the other fellow's doing. You're an individual.
Yep. You're taking the words right out of my mouth. What has been lost on the ethical level is individuality. The individual human being has been subjected to the system. We get TV dinners. See, which is institutionalized food.
They get us.
Yeah, see. And you go to the supermarket, can you get anything that hasn't been organized? Can you buy 100 pounds of potatoes? I guess here and there you can. Can you buy 100 pounds of navy beans? Only if you know some wholesaler that can get it for you. Could you when we were kids? Sure you could. See, we had unorganized grocery stores. We had stuff sitting around in barrels.
And you pay for this.
Well, sure you do. That's where all the costs come from.
And you can do it too bad.
Well, sure it is. And that's why, you know, it's about time. But we can't say, all right, let's roll back the clock. Although some people try to do that. But what we have to do is to say, all right, look, this way of doing things is dumb. There's got to be something better than this. Let's start doing it this kind of way. All right, well, what the great thing about the ethical life is it's safe and secure. And unexciting. Life is totally secular. Why? Because the essence of secularity is to be objective. Where the meaning of life is outside oneself. And this is why an institutional church inevitably always has to fight the problem of becoming secular. We're going to introduce new business methods into the church. You know, we'll get as much as we can out of every buck that poor widow contributes for the church, you know. And we'll have systems analysis, and by golly, we'll really organize headquarters of the church, and we will go, go, go. And we use good business methods for evangelism and who knows whatever else. Someday, unless we stop it, come some Sunday morning and you walk into church and you put on a set of earphones and you press a button for the sermon of your choice, you know, which is given to you by your friendly parish computer with a lovely gilt cross up on the top of it. See? And you plug in whatever liturgy you want to participate in, and you get, you know, you can pick sermon by topic and length. So you have automat worship. Technologically possible already. I'm surprised that some enterprising clergyman hasn't thought of that and made himself $1 million and retired. But you know, that's the absurd thing. The highest ethical person becomes, now when we're talking about ethics in the best sense of the term, the highest ethical person becomes the tragic hero. In other words, the person that we look up to the most is the tragic hero. Socrates, you know, died of hemlock for his teachings. He corrupted the youth by teaching that there is such a thing as objective truth and objective goodness, and he taught them that there was only one God, and that God was good, and didn't hanky-panky around with human beings. Heresy, so he was executed. He mentions, in the Old Testament, he mentions Jephthah. And you recall, Jephthah was the great judge of Children of Israel, a very fine man, went out to fight against the enemy, And he promised God that if God gave him the victory, he would sacrifice the first living thing that was his when he returned home. And he comes home having won a great victory, and his little daughter, who loved him dearly, comes running out to meet Daddy and throws her arms around him, and she sacrificed. You know, and you lose on principle. The highest ethical person is the person who has to make the great personal sacrifice for the sake of goals. And Kierkegaard says there has to be a higher ideal than that, much as we may admire that. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay.